You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Anthony Horowitz returns to the show this week. He's the author of many fine thrillers and television plays. He's the creator of some great books for young adults as well, including the Alex Rider series and the Gatekeeper series. He created and wrote the marvelous television series Foyle's War, about a detective in an English town who investigates crime in a time of war. And he has just published his third 007 novel. It's called With a Mind to Kill, a James Bond novel. Did I say that correctly?
You said it with a lot of sinister edge to it.
Anthony Horowitz, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Real pleasure to talk to you again, Gary.
You know, it's hard to believe that it's been 20 years since Foyle's War. It's the 20th anniversary of Foyle's War, essentially.
It makes me feel very old. But actually, you know, the worst thing is when you write books for young people. I mean, the Alex Rider books have been around for a while now. And I meet people in their 30s, you know, carrying babies. And they read me when they were 7 or 8 years old. And it just changed the march of time. But I'm still here, still writing, so I can't complain.
Well, I'm a huge, as you know, because we've talked about it before, I love Foyle's War. And I'm still waiting for the Cold War Samantha Stewart series that I know you're going to run.
It's going to be a long wait, Gary, I'm afraid.
Now, you told me in an earlier conversation that we had about Foyle's War that the actors you had in the cast, Michael Kitchen and Honeysuckle Weeks and so on, they influenced the way that you wrote the series. That is, you knew who your actors were and what they could do, and that influenced your writing to some degree. And so now you've written a new James Bond story. You've written three of them now. And when you write James Bond, and I know your James Bond stories are based on the works of Ian Fleming and not necessarily the movie character, but still, which James Bond do you envision when you write him? Is it George Lazenby or Timothy
Dalton? I met George Lazenby, you know, a couple of years ago in a London restaurant. I must tell you this story because I was in a restaurant in London. And I'm sitting there with a friend of mine, and I look across and I said, isn't that George Lazenby? You know, that's so amazing. It's, you know, it's James Bond. And my friend says, God, you've got to go over and say hello to him and such. And I said, no, I can't do that. I'm too shy. And, you know, he's having lunch and he doesn't want somebody. Anyway, 10 minutes later, I look up and he's at my table and he's come over and he said, Anthony, are you Anthony Horowitz? I just want to say hello. I know your books and everything on the Bond novel. And he was so lovely. What a lovely man. But having said that, you asked me who I think of when I write the books. I think his movie was, you know, it's been reassessed on Her Majesty's Secret Service. For a long time, people always said it was, you know, not a good Bond film. But now people looking back see an awful lot of it, including his performance, that is really wonderful. And I agree with that. But the Bond I think of when I'm writing the books, I see Sean Connery. That's simply a question of my age. I was brought up on, I still remember Dr. No when I was about 9 or 10 years old, seeing that in the movie and then in the cinema, and then going on to read the books after that. So I see Sean Connery, but I hear Sean Connery, but I see Daniel Craig. So it's Sean Connery's voice in my head and Daniel Craig's face in my eyes.
And you've obviously a fan of Daniel Craig's films. And so I have to ask you, being the current writer of James Bond, do you think that, have you seen No Time to Die? And what do you think is the fate of James Bond?
Well, I try to make a rule of not commenting on the movies because, as you said in your introduction to this conversation, the movies and the books are very, very different worlds. And what they do is what they do, and they do it very, very well, and they have a huge following. And what I do is just try to stick to the world of Ian Fleming. But if you're referring to the end of the last Bond movie, I was a little bit thrown. Let's put it that way. It's not something I would have done. I like the character too much. And I believe the character belongs to the world. He does not belong to Eon Productions, even if they have bought the rights to him. So the resolution did slightly sort of, I can't say I loved the ending of it. But the rest of it, you know, everything Daniel Craig has done, he's a terrific
Yeah, boy. Good. Did you see it coming as you were watching the movie? Did you think, oh my God, they're going to do this?
I don't know why you and I are being so coy about saying what actually happened to
him. Well, he's dead. Oh, yes.
Must know.
Too late for spoilers.
End being the operative word here. But
yeah, he dies. Yes.
They kill him. I didn't see it coming. No. As I say, it's not something I would have done myself because the character is not mine. Funnily enough, since you mention it, when I wrote the book with A Mind to Kill, one of my very first thoughts was, this is going to be the last mission in Bond's life, according to me anyway, in my canon. So maybe I should kill him at the end of it. I did have a sort of one version of the book, had him on a plane coming back to London, and the plane is sabotaged and falls out of the sky. And the book was going to end with Bond plummeting towards the earth, and you wouldn't know. So there was sort of an ambiguous, and I didn't do that because I just felt it was a sort of a slight impertinence. He's not my character, so therefore it is not beholden upon me to kill him.
Right, I kind of feel the same way, and of course I waited all through the credit sequence, which is about 17 minutes long, to see if it would say James Bond will return, and it does in fact say James Bond will return.
I didn't actually notice. I left before the end, probably too upset to wait to get through the end of the credit. But, you know, it's going to be a hard act to, you know, it's a hard act to follow because Daniel Craig was so great.
So great.
But it's also a hard act to follow because Bond has been blown to smithereens and poisoned. I mean, how dead can you be? So whether you know, how they'll do it is anybody's guess. But, you know, maybe they'll go back to the beginning again. Maybe they'll start with, you know, the you know, Casino Royale and they only have done that one. I mean, From Russia With Love or Dr. No or the earlier ones and, you know, just begin the whole lot again.
Well, I know a book they could base it on that would be a good origin story for James Bond.
That's what you have in mind.
So you've written three great Bond novels. I loved all three, and I know you say that this is your trilogy and you're done, but I hope you'll change your mind. But so in your first book, which you neatly tucked into right after Goldfinger, Trigger Mortis, which I absolutely thought was wonderful, and then your second book is the very first thing that happens is 007 is dead. And then we realize quickly that that was a different 007. And that's our James Bond origin story. And now this book you've set at the end of all of Ian Fleming's story. So a couple of weeks after The Man with the Golden Gun, I guess it is, right?
That's correct.
So you've told the entire story of James Bond in your three books.
Oh, hardly. I wouldn't go that far. No, I've done three episodes in an amazing life. And, you know, there's other writers, you know, other continuation authors, and Fleming himself have filled in all the different gaps in between those things. But since you mentioned it, you know, the Trigger Mortis, I always thought I'd do one. I never thought there would be three. And when I finished Trigger Mortis, the estate decided that actually their policy of changing author each time wasn't really working because there was no continuity. And also, to be fair, my, you know, people had liked Trigger Mortis, so, you know, they were happy to come to me for a second one. And I wondered whether I should do it. And then this line just popped into my head. So 007 is dead. And this idea occurred to me that 007 is not a man, it's a number, a designation. And I suddenly have this idea, it'd be quite fun to write this book, you know, explaining what made James Bond, Bond, not like Charlie Higson did with the very, very good young Bond novels that he wrote, but, you know, just looking at Bond's first missions, and Fleming had left clues behind that there was going to be this, you know, this very silent and bloody murder that would take place. And I wanted to sort of explore why that happened, etc. So that was the reason for the second book. And then when I got to the end of the second book, and that did very well, Forever and a Day, again, I didn't know if I'd do a third one, but then what happened there was that, again, the estate came back to me, and it just occurred to me that actually a trilogy was the thing to do, beginning, middle, end. Why not? Let's see what happens, you know, to Bond in 1963. So you say, you know, maybe I'll come back and do more. I feel like my work is done, if you like. I feel I've, you know, got nothing more to say. But, you know, at the same time, I once announced I was going to do no more Alex Rider, and that was sort of four or five books ago.
Well, that's right. I remember you telling me this. I don't understand how you could write as many books as you do because, you know, you have so many. I don't understand how you must be right every single day.
no social life, no friends, no nothing to do with myself. I sit in a room just day and night, just writing. No, it's not quite like that. You know, but you know the answer to the question, Gary. I love writing. I am passionate about writing. I'm never happier than when I have one of these in my hand, fountain pen, to be sitting at a table. I love everything about writing. And since the age of 10, when I was a pretty talentless child, I mean, you know, a little overweight, sad, silly, stupid, not successful kid, I had only one thing going for me, which is the ability to tell stories. And that's sort of all I've ever done. And yeah, it does. It has mounted up. This year, I have 3 books coming out, which is sort of insane and scary. But it's partly down to COVID, because I was writing through COVID, but publishers weren't publishing. So,
right. Yeah. Well, that's great. And I love everything you write. So I'm happy that you're writing and I'm reading.
Goldfinger. He's the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch. Such a cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with author Anthony Horowitz. He has written many fine mystery novels. Some of them are continuations of other characters, like 2 Sherlock Holmes novels and 3 James Bond novels. The first one was called Trigger Mortis. I love that title. Then he wrote Forever and a Day, and his brand new book is called With a Mind to Kill, a James Bond novel. I think you'll enjoy them all. He's also the author of The Magpie Murders and The Mayflower Murders, both of which are forthcoming television series. Watch for Magpie Murders coming on PBS very soon.
Now, your new book is set in the 1960s, and it's a Cold War setting with Russia as the enemy. And I wonder, you know, obviously you wrote that book long before the current war with Ukraine. But do you think that your Cold War Russia resonates with readers right now?
It's a difficult question to answer, because I'm very nervous broadly of saying anything about Ukraine as it were to support or to, you know, or to promote this book, because what is happening in Ukraine is so horrible and tragic and in a, it's something I never expected to see in my life. You could talk about Foyle's War. In fact, you did talk about Foyle's War. The sort of images that we were creating in Foyle's War of rubble and evacuees and of bombing and wounding, I never thought I'd see that in my life. But that was behind me. So it is a difficult area to talk about broadly. But that said, I think that the roots of what you might call Putinism are to be found in the Cold War. I think that the what I'm writing about in the book, and the sort of the in a very fictional and very, you know, highfalutin sort of way, does touch on where this all begins. I mean, I remember reading a book by Orlando Figes about sort of Stalinism and what it did to the people of Russia. And I think that book also has extraordinary echoes down the centuries as to what is happening now and where we are now. So yes is a short answer to your question, but that sort of, you know, I'm not talking about Russia or Russians, but I am talking about the minds behind this horrible, horrible war. And I do think that, you know, Putin and the KGB find their origins, you know, long before the Berlin Wall came down.
I visited the Soviet Union in 1972, and I did feel this thing that you describe really well in your new book, With a Mind to Kill. I have to make sure I say it properly. That feeling that there's, you know, you talk about a nighttime scene in Moscow where there's like nothing going on. The people are not coming home from restaurants. They're not. The thing I noticed when I was in Russia, in the Soviet Union, was that you never saw people just sort of standing around or whistling or even smiling.
Or embracing or laughing or doing anything really. I mean, I was also in Moscow in the 70s. I went to research another book when I was really very young, in my early 20s. And I have very strong memories of Moscow at that time. And for that matter, I went through the Berlin Wall. I went through Checkpoint Charlie. So I saw the Berlin Wall when it was up. I saw the Stasi. I saw that sort of world as well. And one of the things I will say is that one of the difficulties I had in this book was drawing on the sort of the bleakness, the sort of the misery and the awfulness of that society at that time, in the 60s, that would be 63 when the book is set, without making it a depressing, gloomy, boring read. That was a real problem I had, was to still make it true to what we expect from James Bond, whilst in some way trying to reflect what I remembered of Russia at that time. And if you look at the back of the book, I also read in Sydney a lot of books about Russia in the 60s. And I was thinking of course, of Le Carré. One of the influences of the book is The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, published in Sydney in the same year that this book is set, 1963. Yeah. And there are hidden in the text one or two, if you pick them up, little sneaky references to that book and to Le Carré. So I'm very interested in the fact that this book bridges the world from spy writing that we remember, the sort of the great Bonds, Moonraker, From Russia We Love, Doctor No, etc., all those sort of quite glamorous and fun books, into a much bleaker world. You know, the year before 62, I think it is, Len Dayton produces his first spy novel with Harry Palmer, yeah, and then you've got Harry coming in. So you're losing one world and moving to another, and that's what this book does.
Well, now, Ian Fleming, I'm not going to say that he was a racist or a sexist, although it's clear from his writing that he was racially and gender insensitive, and that therefore 007 has those qualities as well, because we hear it in his head when he thinks in James Bond's novels. So now, today, we have a more enlightened readership. So how do you take the character of Bond as created by Ian Fleming, and how do you deal with that aspect of the character and the writing?
Well, first of all, I didn't necessarily buy your premise that Fleming was, you know, racist, sexist, and all that, because you've got to bear in mind that in the 50s, you know, Casino Royale is what, 1953, all the way through to the 60s, you know, these attitudes, these views just did not exist. And therefore, you know, some of his Live and Let Die is a very good case in point of a view of Black Americans that would not now be acceptable. But back then was how they were seen. Fleming's attitude to Jews, you know, Goldfinger is a Jew, and his Jewishness is part of his malevolence. But again, you know, I am a Jew myself, but I cannot find it in my heart to be resentful or angry about Fleming, because it was just how people were then. And when I'm writing my books, or Fleming books, my Bond books, I am writing with that mindset. I am in the 50s. I am not particularly concerned about putting out messages that smoking will damage your health, or that you know, that Bond's treatment of a certain woman is perhaps a little bit objectifying and just over masculine sort of in some ways. I feel like I'm tying myself in knots there, but actually it's fairly simple. My job is to be true to the original ethos, to be true to the 50s, but in a way that will not offend, upset, annoy people who have different views now. So Pussy Galore appears in my first novel, Trigger Mortis, but I would not create a character like Pussy Galore. I would not suggest that a woman who has chosen to be a lesbian all her life will, the moment she meets Bond, throw that all out of the window and go to bed with him. It doesn't work now. In the original book of Goldfinger, it's a sort of a smile, really. It's a wish fulfillment as well on Bond's or Fleming's part. And I also incidentally defend Fleming's attitude to women inside the Bond novels. Bond is never cruel to a woman. He's often extremely kind. Look at his relationship with Tracy on Her Majesty's Secret Service, or with Honeychild in Dr. No, where one of the first things he does is to suck out the sea urchin that she's got in her hand or something. I think that is the correct book. Yeah. and Gala Brand in Moonraker, who rejects him at the end of the book and says, look, we're attracted to each other, but it's not happening because there's a policeman I've met and I'm marrying him. And Bond doesn't sort of take that as an insult. He's respectful. He walks away. So broadly speaking, his attitude to women, both Fleming's and Bond's within the books, is respecting. And so from my point of view, it's not too difficult to carry that mantle, to have some of the same attitudes, but to write them in a way that is inoffensive in the 21st century.
In Foyle's War, one of the hallmarks of Christopher Foyle that doesn't change is that he does not show his emotions. He never tells his son, for instance, that he loves him, or he doesn't hug his son. But it's very clear that he loves his son, but he just doesn't say it or show it. And it, the same with his relationship with Sam. He obviously has paternal feelings for her, but he never says anything to her that would indicate it other than his actions. So in some way, do you think that Bond, when he, in his mind, when he calls a woman a bitch or something, is it a British suppression of emotion that happens within him?
Again, it's very much part of the period. I mean, you know, the Second World War and after it, people didn't emote quite as much as they do nowadays. People weren't so angry. People weren't so expressive of what they were feeling. It was just not done. I mean, this is a modern phenomenon that people now, as it were, wear their hearts on their sleeves. And also at the same time take so much more offense than people might have done then. So I think that it's James Bond is not a psychologically deep character. I think there are things about him that are fascinating, and the more you read about him and write about him, the more facets to his character that you see. But at the end of the day, I think he's more a mythical figure than a real one. You know, if you think about it, time after time after time, he comes up against these extraordinarily monstrous villains, and all the odds are against him, but he doesn't die. He doesn't get killed, except in the last film. He survives. He wins time after time after time. And in the films, too, he can run from, you know, from A to B with 50 people firing machine guns at him, and somehow not a single bullet. These people are not. You know, not these people are not like you and me. They aren't completely human. Kingsley Amis, in his book about Bond, the James Bond dossier, talks about Bond as being the Dark Knight. And using those words, of course, brings us to sort of Batman. It's that sort of superhero thing. I think that the genius of Bond is that he is recognizable as a human being, whilst at the same time he isn't quite one in reality.
Well, is it challenging for you? Is it like a puzzle to write other people's creations? And we've done Sherlock Holmes. You wrote some Poirot teleplays. Would you like to try a Poirot novel or a Miss Marple novel or a Philip Marlowe or Sam Spade novel?
Well, definitely not a Poirot novel. That's Sophie Hannah. She's doing a fine job, so I'll leave that to her. Not Miss Marple either. They're just about to bring out a series of short stories, all written by women, incidentally, an interesting idea. And I'm looking forward to that. Kate Moss, a friend of mine, has written one of them, so I'm very interested to see what she's done. Chandler, no, too difficult. Couldn't do it, I don't think. I admire the books enormously, but they are really, really... I don't think you could better what he has done. You can't better Fleming either, or Doyle, but I don't think I could even come close. I think I've done with continuity novels, or whatever you want to call it, continuation novels. I think I've got plenty of my own books to write for the next, you know, and I'm getting on a bit. So I don't have that much time left to sort of, you know, dabble with other people's work.
We're the same age, so I don't want to hear you say that.
Well, listen, it's not a question of dropping dead. It's a question of when does the inspiration dry out? When do I find it too hard to find the words? Yeah. But it's no, I think I'm, you know, also the other thing about this is, look, I loved Bond from the age of 10. I loved Sherlock Holmes from the age of about 16, 17. I loved Agatha Christie from the age of about 19, 20, working on the Poirot show with David Suchet. So writing these things was a labor of love. I don't want to just step in because somebody offers me either money or publication or more publicity and do something else. You know, I don't think it's another character. The only thing I've often said is I would love, another of my childhood influences was Tintin, and I would love to perhaps finish Tintin and the Alpha Art, which was the last graphic novel that Hergé was working on when he died, but that won't ever happen. So it's just sort of a long dream.
I was thinking you could do a great Tarzan story. I think Tarzan needs. I'm a big Burroughs fan. I think you would have fun with him.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, Tarzan. I think Tarzan is tricky. I think a man in a loincloth swinging through the trees. I'm not sure what I would do with that.
He's a detective.
Is he?
Yes.
Yes, of course he is. But no, I think. No, the answer is no. Yeah, tempting me. I've got Hawthorne. I've got Alex. I've got plenty of stuff to be getting on with.
You only live twice, or so it seems. One life for yourself, and one for your dreams.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and this week we're talking with mystery author Anthony Horowitz. He's the author of Magpie Murders and Mayflower Murders, 2 Sherlock Holmes novels, and 3 James Bond novels, including his brand new one, With a Mind to Kill. He's also the creator of the brilliant television series Foyle's War, as well as Midsummer Murders, and he contributed quite a few episodes to the Poirot series. We'll continue our conversation with Anthony Horowitz right after this.
You have a bunch of things that you're working on, and I want to find out about them. You mentioned you have 3 books coming out. So tell me about some of the other books you have that are just about to come out or just came out. You had come in.
One of them I can show you because it happened to arrive just today. I'm holding up the Diamond Brothers. The Diamond Brothers are all film parodies. And so it's a very thick 25-year-old, very stupid 25-year-old detective who's helped out by his kid brother who is 14, and these are children's books, of which there are many, many, and this one, Where Seagulls Dare, will tell you where I've gone for my inspiration. I'm very happy to ask, but that's my next book out after Mind to Kill. Then after that, there's going to be my 4th Hawthorne novel. These are detective novels in which I turn up as a character. I don't know if you've come across them, Gary, but the idea is that instead of being the cleverest person in the book, the narrator, I'm the most stupid person in the book, the sidekick, always sort of trailing behind the detective. And I'm loving writing them. And in fact, today I finished the edits on the new one, which will be out in August, I think. Then after that, probably another Alex Rider next year. Certainly 2 more Hawthorns. There are going to be 12 of them in total. I want to do another series, a book in the series of Magpie Murders, Moonflower Murders, which has Leslie Manville starring in the version
TV series.
PBS will be showing it later this year.
It's
an absolutely wonderful six-part series. I say it, who shouldn't, but I'm not claiming credit for it. I give that to Leslie Manville, who is just stunning as the lead character in it, Susan Ryland, an editor rather than a detective, and the direction by Peter Catania, famous for The Full Monty.
And you've written the teleplay.
I did, as it happened. I did adapt the book and turned it into it. My wife, Jill Green, was the producer. So, and I'm very, very proud of it. It's a really wonderful piece of work. And that, as I say, that's going to be shown towards the, you know, the second half of this year.
Oh, good. Looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah, I do hope you get to see it, and I hope one day we can talk about it. And then after that, I don't know, really. I mean, I've got another murder mystery I'm doing for Sony, set in the Mexican jungle, filmed in Colombia, but set in the Mexican jungle, which is sort of an Agatha Christie-esque, or sort of a modern take on Agatha Christie. You know, there's plenty happening. It's that's why in your earlier question of doing any more continuation novels, I didn't think so.
Well, you were recently, and I'm an American, I don't know anything about all this, and so I'm very curious. The commander of the Order of the British Empire, you were awarded this. And what does it mean, and how did it happen, and did you go there? Did the Queen give it?
I'm not sure quite what it does mean, actually. The honour system in this country is very peculiar. I was an OBE, which was the Order of the British Empire, but then I got promoted this year to CBE, which is Commander of the British Empire. And if I go one step further up the ladder, although even talking to you about it means I almost certainly won't, they're watching, I'm sure, at this very moment.
Oh, yes.
Then you get to knighted. That's knighted, sir, whatever. And it's, look, the honor system is, at its best, it is a very nice pat on the back. Do I get a medal? Yes. Who gives it to me? Could be Prince Charles. It could be Prince William. You know, either Buckingham Palace or Windsor Castle. It's a lovely day out. It's exciting. It's fun. And it's sort of harmless, really. And so I'm very happy to have it. There are those who say that having the word empire in this medal is already tarnishes it, that, you know, that we shouldn't be proud of the empire, the British Empire. But you know, what I like about the honor system is that, yes, at one end of it, there are Smersh-style villains and weapons dealers and corrupt politicians who seem to be getting knighthoods and this and that medals all over them. But at the other end of it, there are nurses and doctors and firemen, or firefighters, I should say, fire women too, and you know, people who are teachers and people and charity workers and social workers, and you know, they also can be given these medals and these honors. And I think it's absolutely wonderful that they should have their moment in the sun.
Have you met the Queen?
I have, on a couple of occasions, in fact. Yes, I can't remember what we said. It's one of the very odd things about meeting royalty is that you sort of just, well, I just froze. I mean, you know, gosh, that's the Queen. What do I say now? the monarchy is in a difficult place right now, and I hope it finds a way. I think it's going to have to transform itself quite dramatically for the next sort of, you know, for the next phase, especially after the Queen, Queen's reign is over.
Should that ever happen?
Well, you know, she is in her 90s, and she is, of course, remarkable. And I think it will, you know, the country has this extraordinary affection for her. And with everything that's happening in this country at the moment, she is a beacon of light and remains so.
I agree. I like her a lot. I think she's great. And I think actually, like, because of the crown, the attitudes of people around the world have probably changed toward the Queen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, things are changing all the time. You know, the Commonwealth is changing, and attitudes towards the monarchy, towards the empire, towards some of the perceived crimes of the Brits in the 19th century and the 18th century, whatever. I think being a writer now is scary in some ways, because the forces of change are not only so rapid, but it can be so aggressive, so violent even. You know, the sort of, you know, some of the things we've been talking about in this conversation about sort of, you know, the attitude towards women and towards minorities or of one sort or another. It's I think writers have to now have a careful antenna to what is happening. I don't think writers need to be scared. I don't think writers don't need to be suppressed. We should do what we want to do. But there are going to be consequences if we get it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you can just make a statement off the top of your head without thinking it through that will have ramifications. People will, or you could tweet something that, will come back and haunt you 5 years later or whatever.
Well, Gary, I'll be honest with you. I never, ever now make a statement without thinking it through, even talking to you now. Whenever you ask me a question, all the sort of the safety switches click on and sort of, can I answer this? How do I answer this? What can I say that will not cause me grief a week or a month from now?
Yeah.
And that's not good. I mean, really, I do think that one of the things about the 21st century in modern times that is alarming is the kickback, the sort of the way that people who are in the public eye, who may be well-meaning and who are simply trying to ply their trade, in my case, to sell books, can inadvertently cause themselves all sorts of grief.
The way John Lennon did when he mentioned that he thought the Beatles were more popular than Jesus, without implying, anything about his belief in religion or whatever, but that turned out to be
One thing is that one of the few things you can get away with in this country, in Britain now, is to sort of, besmirch the Christian church any way you want to, and nobody looks too uptight.
Yeah.
It's a strange part of our life that, politicians, the church, all the sort of columns on which this country was built, they can be knocked down by anybody, but there are now groups of people who take great offense if you're not careful, and I'm afraid I always am.
So you think that affects people's conversations, this type of a conversation that will be listened to by a few listeners is less unguarded and less casual than it might be?
I try when I'm talking to you just to answer your questions honestly and in hopefully a way that is sort of interesting and enlightening and helpful. I am by nature a very positive person. I try to think of the world as getting better all the time, even when we have so many things happening around us at the moment. Ukraine, we've discussed. We could have mentioned COVID. We could have talked about politics in my country, which are in a dire state. Actually, not quite as bad as politics in yours, but close. I try to be positive and forward. But yeah, I will be honest and say that I have learned from my own experiences now that I do have to weigh my words, which is bad. It's not a natural way of things. It's not a natural way to run your life, that you have to constantly have a sort of a nervousness, a certain sort of, social media and the press for that matter, and the sort of the pylons that we now see in modern society when somebody steps out of line. That wasn't like that 20 years ago. I could chat to you, I could say something remarkably stupid, possibly even offensive, but it wouldn't be a career destroyer. Now it might destroy my life. That's where we are.
And we're also aware, you mentioned the politics in our two countries and in the world, that there seems to be a movement toward rather than away from authoritarian government. So when you write a book like With a Mind to Kill, it's about living under an authoritarian government, and it's bleak. Are you influenced by the politics of the day when you're telling your stories? Is there a reason that you set it in the Cold War? I mean, is consciously or subconsciously?
No. The reason that the With a Mind to Kill is set in the Cold War is simply because I wanted to write about Colonel Boris. Colonel Boris is the guy who brainwashes James Bond, and he does that in 1963. So I am stuck in the Cold War whether I like it or not. And I had absolutely no political drive to write that book. Curiously, if you want a book that has a bit of politics in it, it's this one. It's actually about a right-wing extreme organization. So it has got a bit of political satire. I hope children won't notice it, but in between the lines, it's completely there. And I think it's an interesting thing that writers like me, who have a voice, have a choice as to whether they use that voice or not. And I always think to myself that at the end of the day, my publishers and their sales reps and all the people who work for them, and the bookshops who sell my books, and I'm sort of the whole apparatus of sort of, you know, literature and literacy and books, depend on me not alienating half an audience by suddenly coming out with a political opinion that they might disagree. Brexit, yes or no? You know, if you say I thoroughly oppose Brexit or I'm thoroughly for Brexit, it's fantastic, you might alienate a chunk of your readers. And that's great if you've got strong political views. I do have strong views, but it's not what my job is. My job is simply to sell a new James Bond novel, to tell it, to sell it, to entertain people, not to be the cleverest person on the hill telling everyone about how awful or great or whatever, you know, certain policies are.
When you write a story like a television series like Foyle's War, my favorite, is it advantageous to set it in a different period of time?
Absolutely. Writing Foyle's War is a joy because it's set in the 40s. And I don't have to worry about all the sort of panoply of modern life, you know, even whether it's mobile phones, social media, 24-hour news cycles, science, computers, Elon Musk, or whatever. You know, that's all away. I'm just into the story and the pleasure of telling the story. The Magpie Murders, Moonflower Murders series, the Atticus Punt, same thing. Generally speaking, I'm much happier. My reading, what I read, I like 19th century novels. I like Dickens and Austin and Hardy and Trollope and people like that. I read modern fiction too, but I am much more comfortable in an older world. That's partly to do with my age, you know. But it's we live in interesting times. Basically, that's the bottom line of it. And it's interesting, you know, when you've mentioned that we're the same age. When you get to our age, you are inevitably going to move towards the sidelines of the world. It is no longer our world. It is our children's world. Maybe it is our grandchildren's world if we have them. I don't yet. But nonetheless, it is, you know, we've had our time as, you know, and as I had said earlier in this interview, how lucky I am that, you know, I managed 60 odd years, but before Ukraine happened and before the world went mad, before COVID happened. I feel very sad for young people having to contend with all this. But at the same time, I'm aware that because they're young, they don't see it that way. This is their world. They'll deal with it.
It's their problem now. We don't have to protest.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's their problem. I'm saying that they don't see that there is a problem. They grow up with this. They will deal with it.
Well, the new book is called With a Mind to Kill. I want to make
you
sure.
You do it very well each time. I'm sorry. Our conversation has gone rather a long way away from it.
A James Bond novel. And you also have The Magpie Murders coming on TV. There's another TV series that we didn't mention, New Blood, right? Is that what it's called?
New Blood was something I did a few years ago, in fact, for the BBC. And it's sort of still knocking about. You can see it here and there. It wasn't recommissioned. It's sort of one of those ones that got away. It's a little bit of a sort of a sad thing. I hope we're not going to end on it. But I'm proud of the work we did on it. And I love the two actors who play the leads in it. And I'm sorry it didn't work out. But, you know, you television, books, anything you do. I'll give you something I often say when I'm visiting schools. If you're afraid of failure, you can never really succeed. You've got to take it as it comes. Not everything I write is going to be loved and be hugely popular and win awards. But that doesn't guide what I write. What I write is what I want to write and what I believe in. And, you know, I take failure and success, you know, as equal sort of equal partners.
Well, I'm a great admirer of your work, and I'm so happy that you're out there writing, and I hope you continue writing for a long time. And congratulations on With a Mind to Kill. And as always, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope we talk again soon.
Gary, thank you so much for talking to me again. It's a pleasure for me too. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.